We are delighted to say that we've once again been selected by the Big Give for this year's Green Match Fund, which means every donation we receive will be doubled. This time around, we're raising funds for our science and research work, and we're hoping to raise £10,000, and the Big Give would match each donation made. Donations must be received via the Big Give website, which will go live on the 18th of April and will remain open for 1 week only until the 25th of April. Every donation will make a difference. We've put a link to the donation page in the show notes.
This is Bat Chat, the podcast from the Bat Conservation Trust. So it's a bank holiday weekend, and I'm staying in a campsite on the edge of Stroud in Gloucestershire, and I'm walking down through a green wooded valley, and I'm on my way to see Ray Cannon from the Woodchester Mansion Trust to find out more about the bats that live in Woodchester Mansion. I started off by asking Ray how long he'd volunteered for the Woodchester Mansion Trust.
Since 2006, so that's what, coming up 13 years now. Yeah. I quit work a couple of years before that. I've known about the mansion since 1996, when it came up in a creative writing course, dare I say it, because one of the then volunteers was on the course and he wrote about it one night. And within about 3 weeks, he'd brought the entire class of 16 people up there to have a look at it. So 10 years later, I bumped into him down here and he just said to me, why don't you do something? So, you know, the rest is history, as they say. It started off as a tour guide, and then slowly I've got sucked into the office because IT skills. I blame creative writing and IT for my involvement in this place. I'm now a trustee, and I work in the office a few days a week.
Yeah.
And yeah, that just about brings us up to date, and I just love these creatures. And I'm working, you know, reasonably closely. I mean, I'm providing a little bit of the techie support for Roger when he wants to know things like this. So that's nice. I like it.
So, Ray, we've come up to the first floor of the mansion. And we've come into a little room called the Bat Observatory. In front of us, there's a couple of monitors. Can you just explain what they are?
What we've got some fixed and some static cameras in the bat roosts and around the bat roost area. And the mobile ones are the ones we display to the public. And that means that we can actually see the bats. We normally work with a fixed camera position, but we do have the facility to zoom in and zoom in and focus on particular bats, so we can have screen size bats, you know, a bat a foot high, which is actually quite disconcerting, because when you go down to watch them flying around and you see them hanging up, you suddenly realize just how small they actually are. But the idea of this is it's not just for the public, it's also there for Roger Ransom to do his studies, counts. One of the things he does on a regular basis, weekly during the summer, starting actually this week on the 21st of April. Basically, he'll be down here every week on a Sunday night between now and probably about mid-September, possibly early October, counting the number of bats that are left. And even that's a scientific study as well, because he uses the cameras to watch the bats going in and out of the roost. But it's very high-tech counting, not because basically somebody is sat there focused on that screen with a clicker, left for in, right for out, something like that. And then when the flow has stopped, and part of the science here is Roger's counting them according to the time they leave, according to the light level outside, and in 5 minute intervals, that sort of thing. So, you know, we do this count once a week. So the cameras get used for that as well. We've also got recorders attached to these cameras. So upstairs there's the continuous recording, or as much as we want to record. At the moment we're not doing much, but they're motion sensitive.
And how long ago were the cameras installed?
These particular ones were installed over, we've been running with them for 12 months now. So a majority of them were installed during the period over the winter of the year before last. I mean, we've had a number of cameras around, and the behavioural studies video on there was actually filmed on the previous cameras. Believe me, the the difference in resolution, difference in quality really shows up. What I want to show you just on this one, if I may, if I zoom in, there's a newspaper there on the floor. And pitch black, when it will focus, they're autofocus as well. You can actually zoom in and you can read the print on them. As I say, it's pitch black. I'm glad they left it there, you see, because it's a lovely demo when we do our bat walks. It's a lovely demo of the facility of these things. And then we've got high def screens as well.
And how long was the process of putting the cameras in? Was it a couple of days or was it longer than that?
We've been pretty lucky of working with a company called Scott Total Security, who actually put some security cameras around the building. And this project actually started because they put four security cameras around the sides of the building, and then they offered us one camera to go into one of the roosts. And so we took up their kind offer and they did install one for free, and then we put in the rest of the stuff. So they were enthusiastic about what they were doing as well. And I think probably a couple of visits to actually install the cameras. Putting the cameras in is a matter of a day, I think. You know, they do it within the day. And we've had the, shall I say, electronics expert down here a few times to tweak various aspects of the system. The latest of that was that now we've got the brewery plus the greater, plus the lesser exit and the lesser roost on one screen. And we've got all the greater stuff. We've got a fixed camera. We've got the movable one. And we've got the exit on that camera, on that screen. So that means actually now that everything that's going through recorders for the lessers is on that screen and for the greaters is on the other screen. So that helps to separate things out.
And why are you so keen in showing the bats off to the visitors that you get here at the mansion?
They've been here for a long time. We're trying to make a feature of it. And it also sort of serves as a degree of education as well, because we run half a dozen bat walks during the course of the year. The fact that we've got the facility for Roger to study the bats, and that's primarily what it's for. I mean, the mansion has contributed something, but in fairness, Roger's probably contributed at least 2/3 of the cost. Natural England have also supported us as well in this project. But the fact that we've got these, rather than just having them sat there doing nothing when visitors are here, it makes a lot of sense just to put them on there, because some visitors are, shall I say, terrified by bats. Yeah. But a majority of them are not. They're actually fascinated. And if I happen to be in here and I'm, you know, when visitors are here, I will talk about them and you can see see a sort of degree of fascination. So we're trying to use it as an additional vehicle to promote the mansion, really. It's one of the attributes we've got. If you look at the clock tower, so there are two bat gargoyles on there, which probably indicates to me there were bats around this place 160 years ago when it was built. So, you know, we're promoting it.
And what sort of comments do you get from visitors when they're sat here watching the cameras?
Mainly that they are fascinated to learn a bit about them, because I think most people are totally ignorant of bats. And when you can talk about them, and I mean, I will drop into the conversation the fact that babies are born at 30% of the body weight of the adult, which, you know, is a bit eye-watering when you convert that into a 3-stone baby. But, you know, just telling them a little bit about the life cycle and what they do and when they come. And, of course, we have the other part of the explanation, which I'm trying to address with a couple of little pieces of information there, about if they come in here in early in April, for instance, as they did this year, or mid-September, these cameras are on, they can watch the video, but there's no, you know, there are no bats visible. So the next question is, where are they? Yeah. So you talk about where they go and a bit about the life cycle of bats. And I think most people really do find it interesting. And when we have the bat walks, to see them flying around your head in the back corridor, that is really, you know, it's really thrilling.
And are the bat walks very popular here?
And I think out of the 5 we ran successfully last year, we can only do 15 at a time in here because it just gets too cozy. So 15, 5 of them, that's 75. And I'd say we probably had 70 of those places filled last year. And certainly a couple of them were oversubscribed. And I'm hoping that we can do the same this year. I work with a colleague from the Gloucester Bat Group. So, you know, we'll have about an hour's conversation about the bats, looking at them and such like. And last year, in one particular talk. There's an element on the video of the bat behaviour where bat is shaking off baby before they go out. I love this idea that you can hang the baby up and go and do your shopping, you know. But they were shaking off, and we actually saw that in practice late in July, I think, last year, and it was really magic to see it on there, just as it really does on, you know, you see the pictures of it and then you think, well, okay, that's really happening for, you know, that's happening for real. So yeah, people are interested, and if we can do anything about it, we can spread a little bit of, well, what do you do if you find bats and things like that, I don't handle them and such like, but also dispel the myth that they'll get in your hair. The other thing we've got here, because Roger used to teach in Rednock School in Dursley, so when a picture of Roger comes up on the screen, oh, he used to teach me biology, you know, because sort of, you've got that generational thing. I mean, he's been doing this for years.
As we approach the mansion this morning, the scaffolding up, what sort of challenges are there to looking after a Grade 1 listed building like this?
Now, lots of you have seen me in branded T-shirts and hoodies with the Bat Chat logo on, and you've all been asking me when they'll be available. Well, we're thrilled to let you know that a whole range of Bat Chat clothing and tote bags is now available for you on our T-Mill store. The link's in the show notes. Whether you're a long-time supporter or a new member of the Bat Chat family, we can't wait for you to share your photos of you wearing our merch on social media. Be sure to tag the Bat Conservation Trust in your posts. If you're listening to Bat Chat on Google Podcasts, we wanted to let you know that Google have announced they plan to discontinue their app later this year. So we recommend making the switch to an alternative podcast app, and we've put some links in the show notes to alternative apps that you can follow Bat Chat on so that you don't miss any future episodes.
The building itself, our immediate challenge is we could do with about £5 million. That's what the estimated cost of restoring the building is. We don't plan to finish it, which means that we'll keep it in the state it's in now, so you can see the way a Victorian Gothic building was constructed.
Yeah.
And right at the very moment, of course, it's slightly topical because Benjamin Bucknell, who is the architect for the Victorian bit of this, was a disciple of Viol the Duke, whose name you might have heard crop up not too long, you know, in the last few days because of the burning down of the roof of Notre Dame in Paris. And in fact, it turns out that he was the one who designed the little spire on the top and the one you probably saw the video of falling into the heap. And I've heard one or two comments on the radio, some praising him for what he did and others saying, well, he'd made every church in France look the same. So he's got bad press and he's got good press on that score. Yeah. But the problems we've got, I suppose we've had one immediate problem when we were on the brewery area. Some of the roof there is in a little bit of trouble at the moment. We're going to have to do some remedial work on it. And I thought that we ought to be doing that work during the winter because the bats aren't here. But in fact, Roger was saying you need to be careful during the winter because you find some of the bats, not necessarily the greater and lesser horseshoes, no, because they don't crawl into little spaces, but pipistrelles and things like that will. Therefore, it turns out that probably the best time to do this work is during the summer, providing we're not working there in the hours, because we are going to have some scaffolding or something, probably inside as well as outside, and do some shoring up there. But by and large, that's not it's not a problem at all. Roger is actually very good about what we can do and what we can't do, and we consult him closely, obviously.
Yeah.
A few years back when we were having Halloween parties and things like that on the south side of the building in the main rooms, you know, the issues came up, what effect will this have on the bats? And then again, when we've had filming down here, there are maybe not too worried about the area, providing they stay away from the entrance to the hibernaculum. So, you know, I mean, there's a respect for them, but In terms of actually being a problem at all, that's not an issue. So, yeah.
Great, thank you so much.
Okay.
And in late June, I was back at Woodchester Mansion talking to Dr. Roger Ransom about his lifelong study of the greater horseshoe bats at Woodchester in a very echoey room whilst his volunteers were undertaking a count of the roost using the cameras next door.
Roger, can you just give us a bit of background as to
what the mansion is and what bat species we've got here and what sort of bats you're interested in here?
Well, the mansion's a perfect derelict, abandoned building set in wonderful habitat in a lovely valley, which was originally a monastery garden. It has five species of bats in it. Currently, number one in terms of population size is the lesser horseshoe bat. Second comes the greater horseshoe bat. Thirdly, we have what we believe are common pipistrelles. There's quite a good colony taking advantage of the heaters in the greater horseshoe attic. And then we have a small group of long-eareds, which we haven't really studied at all. And lastly, for the last few years, or probably for perhaps 10 or more years, we've had a single serotine occupying different parts.
And you've been studying the bats here for over 60 years now. How did you end up studying it for so long, and when did you start?
I started as a sixth form student in 1956, which was when I was 16. And I'd gone into the sixth form at 15, and in my second year, we had a talk by a French teacher who used to ring birds, and he'd had gone to France and started helping out with some French people ringing greater horseshoe bats, would you believe? And he gave us a talk, and that talk sparked a group of four of us to actually start a ringing study in the mines of Minchin Hampton and the mansion building itself. I was the only one who was fortunate enough, there were four of us, but I was the only one who was fortunate enough to get into Bristol University, which meant that I didn't have to stop my project whilst I was doing my undergraduate studies. I did a three-year degree and then followed it with a PGCE one-year course. And during all that time, I was accumulating basic data and making sure that I knew the best way of collecting the information. And I had a lot of help from people in Somerset. I was studying lots of different places to see if they were doing, bats were doing the same thing in all these different regions. It was clear to me that what was happening in the different places was following the same sort of general pattern. I was having finished my university degree, university studies, I looked for a job as a teacher, and amazingly, I was so lucky to get, first of all, a position that was available 6 miles from the mansion, and secondly, whether I was the only candidate, I don't know, but I was offered the job. And I stayed at that school for 33 years.
Wow.
And I only left as a result of the national curriculum wrecking the courses that I'd set up at the school. And that sort of pushed me into environmental studies, advice. And a lot of the research done in this building was actually used, and we trialled lots of the mitigation techniques in this building. And from that, I was pretty confident when we came to 2000, 7 years after I left teaching, I managed to get a huge contract to stabilise 45 acres of underground workings, which had 12 species of bats using it. And that gave me an income which could fund generously all of the research which is carried on. So I am independent, and I make my own decisions as to which direction I go. But having said that, I benefited from collaborative help from particularly Gareth Jones.
Yeah.
And a whole series of PhD students who mutually we benefit because they introduce new topics, new aspects of the work. And I'm able to offer them the basic information and the data which they couldn't otherwise obtain.
And you've been ringing the bats all those years. From that, have you been able to see how the population of the horseshoes has changed over time?
Yes, I could have done that without ringing them, actually.
Yeah.
Because now we've done all the trials, we know that the best way to judge a population of greater horseshoe bats is if you know the maternity roost, just go in and count the babies born after dusk exit over a period of 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
And you'll get a good basis for working it out. By individually ringing the bats, we've got unique data which spans several, because they live 30 years, I've spanned two complete cycles of births and deaths. And we followed the numbers which have gone, well, originally where there were 110 babies born in this building in the late 1950s. And then following the severe winters of the early 60s, they slumped to, I think we were down at that stage to 65. And for a long time, they sort of struggled at 65 until we got to the 1980s. And then we had a second very bad series of consecutive bad winters and cold spring. They do the damage.
And do they do the damage because bats can't survive on the fat reserves, or is it because horseshoes need to go out and forage in the winter?
It's partly the winter foraging, but not mainly. The most mortality of these bats is going to occur really generally in April, May and early June. And the killer is early June, because up until the end of May, they can still use prolonged torpor, which is what hibernation is, to actually sit out several days of bad weather. Once you get into June, they can't stay in torpor for more than 24 hours. They wake up every day. If day after day they're not getting anything to eat, within a few days they're dying. But the other factor is when you get a series of bad summers and winters, you get a lot of stunted babies being surviving for short periods. And that really prepares the way for a really bad spring, which happened in 1986. And our numbers went from 65 births to 33 to 20 over two summers.
Wow.
And we nearly lost the whole... And this happened in West Wales, it happened in the Forest of Dean, you know, anywhere where there were proper studies going, showed that this wasn't just happening in Woodchester Mansion. It was happening generally.
And in 2011, you wrote an article for Bat Conservation Trust Bat News, explaining that alpacas can be good for horseshoe bats undertaking winter foraging. How's that so, and how often do horseshoe bats forage in the winter?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. But basically, the two groups of greater horseshoe bats that generally have the greatest problems to survive a winter will be the adult males that have had mating territories, and they've mated with the females in the early part of the winter. And rather like the deer, they deprive themselves of food, and they don't store up the fat that they should do to survive the winter. So The adult male is great risk. And the others that are great risks are the juveniles born very late in the summer, because they've got to wait until they've completed their growth, and that conflicts with depositing fat. You can't do both. What happens is, in the winter, if it's severe weather and you cannot feed, say from January to beginning of March, then you've got a good chance of not surviving that period. But that's fairly unusual. I can't think of many years where that happened. Mm. The worst one was 1962-3, where snow came on Boxing Day and didn't thaw till mid-February.
And where do the alpacas come in then?
Well, now I've got a great deal of time for alpacas. I'm not in favour of introducing foreign species into an ecosystem, but in practical terms, if you're trying to get grazing systems in place close to roosts, summer or winter, sheep are very good, especially in winter. But the trouble with sheep is they suffer a lot from dog owners who are not careful in looking after their animals. And it's very difficult to persuade anybody to graze sheep close to bat roosts. Now, cattle very rarely are left out by farmers, because they need to get their growth through in order to be able to sell them. And now an alpaca, it has a lot of things going for it. One is, it is a very economic animal to keep. You can keep more of them on the same piece of land. They've got soft feet and they don't churn up the turf, which is called poaching, like cows would do or horses. So if you've got alpacas, you've got an animal which is big enough to kick a fox in the face and deter it from, attacking it. And we were very lucky for several years where we had a really nice flock of alpacas going. And then sadly, the owners went through a divorce and fell apart. And I'm afraid it's been very difficult to... All the alpacas had to go, I'm afraid.
And, I mean, the volunteers next door in the camera room are counting out the bats this evening. So populations at the moment seem to be fairly stable. Your last count last week was how many?
Last week was 116, but we've had down to 18 and 17 not so long ago. And we were... I think the big problem is it's easy to... get a regime that will generate certain insects at certain times of year, but if the weather doesn't play ball with you, then it doesn't always work. And the last two springs, we've had two very dry spells in the spring, and it's had a bad effect on the tipulids, the daddy long legs. And I think what happens is you get, in the early spring, you get cockchafers coming along. They're the best diet they can have. Given all the insects they eat at one time, which doesn't happen, but if you could, they would eat cockchafers. They're idiot flyers. They fly low over the ground. They land on the floor. They grab them. But after the cockchafers, if you haven't got tipulids to take their place, the bats just have to go back and spread out all around the hibernation sites again. And then you're waiting for the moths to come. And moths are, as you know, in southern England, haven't done too well. So
populations seem to be fluctuating even now. What does the future hold for the roost here? Where do we go to continue conserving this roost and horseshoe bats in general?
Well, this... colony is extremely fortunate in its own right, because the building here is owned by the Stroud District Council, which used to have the only green council in the country. Because the whole valley is an SSSI, then there is safeguards for the whole of this valley, which is 2 miles long, lovely lakes. We've reinstituted the kind of habitat that was here in the 50s, which sadly went for commercial reasons at that time. So we are adjacent to some pretty significant National Trust pieces of land, which at least means no one can use them for housing developments. The biggest problem we have here is the gradual creeping urbanisation.
Okay.
And this is a big growth area for housing. And down in the valley, there are some substantial developments that have already got consent. Now, what we realised when foot and mouth disease hit the Forest of Dean, when they slaughtered all the livestock in the forest, our bats suffered as well as theirs, even though there was no slaughtering in this valley. We had our normal cows. These dung beetles come in from huge distances because an Aphodius dung beetle can sniff out a cow pancake at 12 kilometres.
Wow.
They are awesome, some of these insects. And we don't really understand this. So it's drawn in from a huge area.
And the housing developments, is that because of a mixture of things? Is it both taking up the land and the connectivity, or is it the lighting strategies, or is it a mixture of things that the housing developments are bad for the local bat roosts?
Well, there are lots of things it could be, but I think what seems to always happen is as you urbanise, then the land around the area can't be farmed in the way that it was before. And what we really need are enough farms who are willing to leave cattle or sheep or alpacas, if they got that, out all the time. Because only the insect life cycles are primarily annual. And if you rob all the winter insects of their food by taking away the geotrupes beetle, which is as big as a cocktail almost. In the Forest of Dean, they're 2 a penny. And when we did diet studies over there, you could see 90% geotrupes. If we catch bats over here and we get the droppings from them, they're full of Ophion wasps. Mm. And they're parasitic on moths. If the moths go down, the parasitic wasps go down, there's no door beetles. So this is why our numbers locally in the Minchin Hampton mines have gone down. Years ago, there were 110 when the cattle were out on feeding on Minchin Hampton Common all year round. Nowadays, they're not there after November.
And you mentioned mines a couple of times. There are basements here in the mansion. Do the bats hibernate here, or do they go elsewhere into the Forest of Dean area?
Well, in the winter, bats have to disperse so that there are fewer of them in a small area and they go short distances. Now, this is a cold valley. And if we used to have up to 20 hibernating here, but no more, when there were 350 total population. So it's not possible, no matter how good the hibernation conditions are here, for them to stay here.
Yeah.
They will go by choice. If the conditions close by at Minchin Hampton were perfect, they'll go over there and form big clusters. But what they don't do that. What they do is they travel across the motorway or under the motorway. They go head for the River Severn, they go down Arlingham and they cross the Noose, where the Severn Borough can be seen, and they go and join the Cinderford bats in the Forest of Dean because they've got loads of food.
So they're travelling long distances.
Even in their first year, you'll get juveniles travel there. But to find those sites, they've got to be born early.
Yes.
So you're back to birth timing.
And being involved with bat work for more than 60 years mean you've seen advances in technology. What bits of tech have really helped with the study, and are there still any bits of original kit that you would prefer over modern technology?
Well, the most important factor for technologically for me was David Bale, who lives in Cheltenham. He and I collaborated together on the sort of detectors we needed to do the monitoring, both for the works and also subsequently. They're the machines that Maggie Andrews uses for her social work, the time expansion, high quality machines, which the French bought in large numbers, you know, but the British didn't use them. And I'm afraid he's got disillusioned, and really it's a tragedy, because I'm using his machines that I bought in 2005, and here we are 15 years later, and they're still working.
Yeah.
And I've got them out there through the summer getting data for Gareth, for some of his students, or for Maggie. And one of the big breakthroughs coming next is going to be social interactions, and I think that's a very fruitful area.
And your work here is thought to be the world's longest continuous study of a mammal by a single person. What's kept your dedication to the study? What is it that keeps you coming back time after time to carry on the study?
My inquisitive nature and my refusal to be condemned by educationists in the past. I think many teachers have no idea what makes a scientist. And you can get a first-class honours degree based primarily on remembrance and regurgitation, and that does not make you a research scientist. Look at the average degree of a Fellow of the Royal Society. It isn't a first by any means.
And what's the hardest thing to keep motivated about the study?
Time. I'm doing so many different things at the moment. It's absolutely not only stressful on me, and I'm amazingly fortunate in my inheritance with my build and my longevity. If you don't live long, you can't study these bats. My wife's, this is the reason.
And the volunteers that you have coming to do the counts, how vital is the help from those volunteers to help you do the study?
Oh, I couldn't do it without them. And we've always had really good. We've got 14, 15 different people now.
Yeah.
So generally, we've got no problem getting people to come. In fact, often I have to disappoint people.
Yeah.
And Colin Morris is, very sad. Vincent Wildlife Trust dispensed with his services, but he's a very great help to me as well. And he comes up from Dorset to help with if we're short for handlers. But none of this could be done on your own. It's just not possible.
Roger Anson, thank you very much.
And if you want to visit Woodchester Mansion, the link to their website, which includes details of when the bats have returned, is in the show notes to this episode. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time when we visit Rye Harbour Nature Reserve in Sussex in the search for Nethusius pipistrelle bats. Until then, don't forget to subscribe, and that way the next episode will automatically find its way onto your phone. Thank you to Wildcare and Wildlife Acoustics for sponsoring the Bat Chat podcast.
Can you hear that?
We can. Wildlife Acoustics creates the world's leading bat acoustic monitoring tools, designed to help scientists make impactful discoveries for our biologically diverse planet, turning this into this. Visit wildlifeacoustics.com to learn more.
Wildcare are committed to supporting the ecology industry and are specialists in supplying a large range of monitoring, conservation and habitat management products, as well as equipment hire and service and repair. With a large range of products, coupled with friendly and expert help and advice, Wildcare is a favourite supplier for ecologists nationwide. Go to wildcare.co.uk to see the full range and quote BatChat at the checkout for 10% off all bat detectors and bat boxes.